Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Charles Frazier, whose latest novel is 13 Moons. First novel is Cold Mountain, which won the National Book Award, very acclaimed novel. Before we move on to 13 Moons, let's talk a little about your earlier career. You taught English, is that correct?
Yeah, I went the sort of graduate school route, went out, looked for university teaching jobs, taught for several years at University of Colorado, North Carolina State University.
You'd never written short stories, anything like that?
I'd written one little, very short story.
When you began hearing about, from your father, I believe, about this relative, Inman, that started you thinking about a novel, or well, what?
I'd been looking for a book idea, and all I knew is I wanted to write something about the Southern Appalachian Mountains, and didn't know whether that was going to be nonfiction, fiction. And then my father, who was working on a family history after he had retired, told me this little story that he had dug up in the family history, and I realized that it was like a very brief outline for a novel.
And you realized at that point you couldn't go nonfiction because the material just wasn't there.
Yeah, it was just this handful of facts about this guy's life and death.
And you found his grave?
The vicinity of it. It's not marked, and it's not certain which one, but it's in a cemetery.
Around what year was this, 93, 92?
Yeah, that was somewhere around there.
At what point did you decide to use the Odyssey as kind of a framework?
That came about because I was just so uncertain about writing a Civil War novel. I'm not real interested in Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and the battles and the strategies and all that. And when I realized that the story I had in front of me was not an Iliad, it was an Odyssey about leaving the war, about going home in search of peace and home and all of those things, then I thought, well, okay, I can write this because I'm leaving Lee and Stonewall Jackson behind.
In reading some of the interviews that you gave about Cold Mountain, it sounds to me that you had a lot of fun doing the research, letters, journals, going to library.
Yeah, that's the part I really like, and sometimes I enjoy it too much to the point that it gets in the way of actually sitting in front of that blank computer screen.
Well, part of the problem, I think, when I talk to people who do historical novels and they begin researching, is they get so much material that the only way to include what they really want is to write a 4,000-page book nobody will read.
Yeah, I mean, it is a temptation to throw everything in. In a lot of cases, I spend a lot of time throwing out all these details. I've spent hours in the library. There's a bit at the start of this book where the main character sees, this is about 1910, he sees a yellow car go down the road. I spent half a day in the library researching cars from 1910, and all it ends up being in the book is a yellow car going fast down the road.
Let's talk about the research for a second. 1993-94, while you were still doing your preliminary and early research on Cold Mountain, researching was different. The Internet was not quite then what it is today,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, back then I recall you could sort of maybe find out if the thing you were looking for was in a library, but you didn't find the thing itself. And now often you find the actual document. I don't do a lot of Internet research. I do some fact-checking kinds of things I'll do, but the wonderful thing to me about going to a library, looking at the physical documents, looking at old books, going to a rare book room in a university library, I end up finding things that are more useful very often than the thing I went to find. And it's all that peripheral stuff that ends up being so helpful.
Well, also it creates this serendipity where the book changes, really changes because you find something you didn't know you had.
Yeah, there are many places in 13 Moons where something ends up being in the book, and the thing that I went to the library that day to find is never made it.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I can remember going to the rare book room at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, looking for, I don't even remember what I was looking for, but what I found was this study of Army documents from the weeks before the Trail of Tears, when the Cherokee were being removed from their homes and farms. And there were records kept of all the possessions of every one of those families. So you could see how many spoons they owned, how many axes, all of that, all the material culture these people listed. And that was enormously helpful, and it's not what I went to the library that day to find.
Do you think you would have had to look for it anyway because you were going to write about it?
I might have run across it in a different way, but I can just remember spending the entire day making lists and lists of those inventories of homesteads.
What didn't you find, and you kind of had to glide over it? Do you remember anything that you were really looking for and went, oh, rats?
I can't think of anything in that category right this minute. I mean, it happens all the time where you think, oh, there's bound to be this thing that I'm looking for. It's got to be out there in the historical record. And then I just, you know, can't dig it up.
At that point, do you kind of throw out the idea or do you fake it?
A little bit of both. I mean, for me, writing historical fiction, you're creating a world that needs to be believable and have texture and, you know, heft to it. It's a fictional process. To me, it's not writing history, it's writing fiction and making that world believable in every way that you can think of to do it. I try not to be bound by the facts of history too tightly.
Charles Frazier, before you began 13 Moons, in those interviews that go back about 8 or 9 years, you were working on material about old mountain resorts and cotton mills in the Deep South. What happened to that?
Yeah. Well, the cotton mills didn't make it into this book, but the mountain resorts end up being, instead of a whole book, maybe 30 or 40 pages of this one.
Well, let's talk about 13 Moons at this point. The main character, and it's told from his point of view, is a guy named Will Cooper. And I guess Will comes from William Holland Thomas, who is the original person based on. Does Cooper come from James Fenimore?
No. I was looking for another name just to signal mainly to people back home who know a little bit about William Holland Thomas that this character doesn't correspond exactly. So I used a family name.
But you chose to stay with Inman in the first book, though.
Yeah. With Inman, there really were only about 5 facts about his life that were knowable. With William Holland Thomas, he was a guy who, first of all, kept journals from the time he was a teenager until he was an old man. So in long stretches of his life, you can find out what he did every day.
At what point did you decide to make the move from old mountain resorts, cotton mills, and all of that, to a book about William Holland Thomas changed?
I had read this little bit years ago during the research for Cold Mountain about an old man in a mental institution in North Carolina who some days would only speak Cherokee. And that little note on a card kept coming back to me, wondering who that man was, what his history was, what his connection to the Cherokee was. And I finally started doing some reading about him and read some of his journals and began reading about the Cherokee at this period of time in the years before the removal and the Trail of Tears, and got more and more interested in some of those details. I mean, just odd things that, you know, that you don't think about with Native Americans, that there were Cherokees who owned plantations as fine as anything in South Georgia or Alabama, Cherokees who owned slaves, who had become as white as anybody outside the Cherokee Nation, and yet somehow we decided we couldn't live alongside them and had to send them away.
We. Andrew Jackson, it sounds like.
Yeah.
The Trail of Tears, the removal, which forms a large portion of the book, you knew that would be central to the book at that point.
Yeah, and I kept that. I mean, one of the things that I like to do is the Southern Appalachians is my sort of home and territory. Once the Cherokee are removed from their farms and leave those concentration camp stockades that they were held in, that's where I leave that part of the story. And it felt like not my story to tell once it leaves my area.
In the way that when Inman leaves the Civil War, it kind of fades away the same way.
Yeah.
Well, you're telling a story.
Yeah.
The Trail of Tears, I didn't know that much about it. I mean, we're talking about genocide. We're talking about ethnic cleansing. How familiar were you with the story of the removal prior to working on 13 Moons?
Well, I knew the general outlines of it. What I didn't know were the real local details. How much the Cherokee at that time, and we're talking about the 1830s here, how assimilated they had become, that they were living almost identically to my ancestors 30 or 40 miles away, just little farmsteads, orchards, pigs and chickens, kitchen gardens, and some hunting. And yet at the same time, we decided we could not coexist. There was no fighting going on. That was long in the past at that point.
What was the reason for the removal? I mean, you know, you keep saying being white people, couldn't coexist. But what was the actual reason? Did you try to delve into what was the thought process behind Jackson's decisions, Andrew Jackson's decisions?
Largely land. We wanted that land that made up the Cherokee Nation. It was a big piece of land, a big hole in the United States, western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, north Georgia, a little bit of Alabama, that at that time was not really part of the United States, and there was a great deal of pressure for settlement in three directions onto that land. So I think that's the main thing. The thing that interested me is that the Eastern Band of Cherokee, the people that became the Eastern Band, were the most traditional of the Cherokee, and the notion of private ownership of property was completely foreign to them. Yet they found a way to use our notion of private ownership to their advantage, and that's why that little group of people is still there in western North Carolina, not in Oklahoma.
Well, let's talk a little about some of the fictional characters and relate them to reality. You have a major character named Featherstone who has an estate called Cranshaw.
Yeah.
He is mostly, I guess he's, well, it's not really clear, but there's a lot of white in him.
Yeah.
He could conceivably pass for a white man. Is that
yeah.
correct? And yet people with maybe even one-eighth white blood were sent away. They were considered Indians.
Yeah, and we had at that time, most states in the South had these legal degrees of deviation from pure white blood all the way down to the 132nd degree. The main thing with people like Featherstone, who lived on the Cherokee Nation, were maybe three-quarter Scot. The head chief of the Cherokee Nation was three-quarter Scot, didn't speak Cherokee. It's that they were citizens of the Cherokee Nation, not of the United States. And Jackson's sense of it was everybody needs to go. They tried to work a deal so the rich people could stay, and Jackson said, absolutely not. If you're not a citizen of the United States, doesn't matter how much money you got to go.
You know, I keep thinking about the Jews in Nazi Germany. That's what seems to come up.
The term genocide is sometimes hard to apply when we look back into the past. But that whole removal of the Cherokee is such a tragedy, whatever word you apply to it. Friends of mine on the Quala boundary, which is the land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee, frequently say, you know, it's a wound that's still open. It hasn't healed. They also point out, we're still here. We've got our land. We're preserving our culture. And they always point out that there's more to their story than the Trail of Tears.
Featherstone himself, is he based on a real person?
Based on a combination of several of those plantation-owning Scot Cherokee.
And you found them through the research?
Yeah.
His wife, Claire?
Claire's a mainly fictional creation.
The similarity there between the search for the lost woman parallels Cold Mountain. Did you realize that when you were working on the book?
Will's a yearner and a kind of a dreamer in a way. And I wanted him to be always looking for these human connections. He starts out the book as an orphan boy sent off to run this trading post on Indian territory. And he's yearning for all kinds of connections, for a father, for a community, for a place in the world, and for that most human connection of family and love. He succeeds in a lot of those things and fails in some of them.
Did the real William Holland Thomas have a wife then? Or?
Yeah, he married late in life to a young woman and had a couple of kids, I think.
The story of Featherstone and Claire's older sister, who he marries them both. Was that common in those days among the Cherokee?
Yeah, it was, that you would kind of take responsibility for almost an entire family when you married a woman. Though on the other hand, the Cherokee, the sort of male-female roles are interesting and complicated. It was a matrilineal culture, and the women pretty much owned the houses and the gardens and farms, and the men were responsible for hunting and war. And by the time of this book, war was over. They had lost for 150 years. And hunting was rapidly going away because the animals were being hunted for the markets, hide markets in Europe. And there was little of that. So all that role of male and female was really in a state of confusion.
And at the same time, the Cherokee were already losing their language.
Yeah.
Which is a main part of culture.
And that role of language as identity is still an important issue among the Eastern Band. And there are lots of initiatives to try to prevent Cherokee from becoming a dead language. And one little tiny piece of that is this work we're doing right now to translate the middle section of this book into Cherokee.
Did you have Cherokees vetting the book?
Not so much vetting the book, but in the last stages, I had some people take a look at it and just say, is there anything here that you feel is just sort of factually wrong, that kind of thing. And then when we had readers' copies of the book, I sent copies to Chief Michelle Hicks and his staff and the tribal council and some elders. And then we had a lunch and just talked about it. I didn't want the book to come out for them to get publicity that they didn't want, for them to be involved in ways they didn't want if they didn't like the book.
You're listening to an interview with Charles Frazier, whose latest book is 13 Moons. You have another character named Bear, the mentor, father figure for Will Cooper. Is he based on anybody, or again, is he just a composite of chiefs?
He's based on a man named Yanaguska, which in Cherokee means drowning bear. He's not a well-known Native American leader, but he's one of the very few who succeeded in resisting the government's kind of overpowering force. I met his great-great-great-granddaughter about 3 weeks ago, and was really happy that she was pleased with the book.
You have another character, Granny Squirrel, a kind of shaman. Is that based on one individual real person?
No, there was a woman named Granny Squirrel who lived in a kind of isolated place that was near where I grew up. But this woman is based on several of the Cherokee healers and medicine people.
And nobody quite knows how many centuries old she is.
The first time a census was done of the Cherokee, early in the 19th century, I think it was, there were several people who listed their ages as 225, 230. So I decided to make Granny Squirrel one of those real elders.
How reliable a narrator is Will Cooper, do you think?
Well, this first-person narration, Will is 90-something years old at the time of the telling. So I think that has to be factored in anyway, that here's an old guy telling his story and doing a great deal of editing and manipulating to tell a good story.
Which means that Charles Frazier kind of has a way out of problems at that point.
Well, it's one of those inherent in first-person narration, I think.
How'd you look for his voice? Did you get that in your head? How did you track that actual voice down?
I started this book in third person and just felt like that the book wasn't developing momentum. And I started it over and over in different ways and finally decided, well, I'll give first person a try, even though I was fairly skeptical. And pretty quickly, this voice began to form of this guy who is in some ways a self-promoter. In some ways, he's plenty happy to criticize himself, laugh at himself. A very forward-moving guy who's always looking toward that next thing that he thinks is going to make his world and the world around him better, even if he's not quite sure how to get there, and even if after he does get there, he's not sure he should have done it to begin with.
How did you balance the older age? Most of the book happens when he's fairly young. How did you balance all that? How serious was the shaping in that direction?
One of the hard things about that, as I was doing it, was trying to modulate the voice to fit the age at the time. And he sort of drifts back into that 12-year-old sense of the world when he's telling that part of it.
It struck me in reading it that it was almost easier writing the earlier segments than the later segments. I don't know.
Actually, it felt easier for me to access the age that's closer to my own right now than to go back to being 12 again.
Okay, this is your second novel. The first, huge success. When you were working on it, what were your fears of the old Harper Lee syndrome? You know, you know, what are you going to do with the second novel? You know, Zadie Smith trying to put together Autograph Man. You know, people, you know, look at John Berendt. I mean, it's a similar kind of problem. Was that weighing on you at all?
You know, I tried not to let it. If you take that into the office every day when you're trying to write, then for me that would be really, really debilitating. To be worrying about how an audience is going to respond, how the publisher is going to respond, any of that kind of thing. Not that I was successful every day at shutting those kinds of things out, but to get a book written, I had to shut it out most days.
And you knew in advance that people would compare it, and probably a lot of people had to find it wanting. There's no way out of that.
Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about that. It's something I tell writers, people working on a first novel who come to a bookstore and ask questions about getting an agent, working with an editor, all of that New York end of it. I always say, you know, that is out of your hands. There's nothing you can do about that. What you can do something about is going to work every day and trying to make your book a little better.
Charles Frazier, some other elements of the book. One is there's a long initiation ceremony taking place in the Cherokee townhouse. Did you experience such a ceremony?
No, I haven't, and actually it would be somewhat unethical or at least impolite if I had been to one of those and wrote about it. In fact, the dance scene in the book, I've had people on the Quala boundary ask, their first question is, have you been to one of those dances? Because if I had, I shouldn't have written about it.
Well, if they're asking the question and they've been there and they think you've been there, then you've done something right, I would guess.
That was really gratifying that they said that scene got the humor of those dances, that particular dance called the Booger Dance is designed not to, as some people have said, scare away evil spirits or something like that. It's they said that we make fun of white people, we make fun of each other, they caricature European nationalities and that kind of thing. It's just a raucous, fun night of laughter.
There's a long segment in the book about a man named Charlie and a massacre that occurs. And this is based on a real massacre, capture and execution of someone named Solly. How did you find out about that?
That's a real central story to the Eastern Band. That has been told so many different ways in terms of historians who've written about it, oral history, among the Cherokees. There are military documents related to it, and it's become, in some versions, a very almost religious savior kind of story, that Solly sacrificed his life, he was executed, in order for the rest of the Eastern Band to be able to stay. What I was trying to do in the story is just think about an old man and his family, fugitives in the woods, in the mountains, in November, in a horrible, horrible situation that there was no good way out of, and to try to tell the human story of it rather than those religious or mythological versions.
And you have Will Cooper joining the army in the search for these stragglers, these people hiding out.
Yeah. That part of it is pretty true to the history, that there was a very ugly deal that had to be made to bring Charlie and the older men in his group in and be executed, and then the army would leave them alone.
When writing that, how hard is it for you to put your own anger and sadness aside in a way to try to get the objectivity of the story?
When I'm dealing with a story like that, I try to keep my mind on actions, on the look of the woods in November, on the difficulties of finding food, on just telling how it might have happened without editorializing hardly at all.
And it appears there's very little editorializing in the book. I noticed that Will's voice is pretty even throughout. He doesn't get that angry. Yeah. It's very accepting.
Yeah, he's telling what happened, aggrandizing himself sometimes, making fun of himself sometimes, but just as a very old man accepting this sweep of history that he saw almost a century of.
Did William Holland Thomas meet up with people like John Calhoun and Davy Crockett?
I know that he and Calhoun were pretty friendly. They actually traveled together some. Crockett, he must have known just because of what a small place Washington was at the time, and that they overlapped some when they were there.
Did you have fun writing the Washington segments at all?
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. Because Washington was just such a work in progress, a muddy mess, a construction project. I read a lot of letters and journals of things like senators' wives talking about the social scene in Washington at the time, foreign travelers coming to Washington.
In some ways, though, in reading it, there are parallels to today. It's like, on one level, nothing's changed.
Yeah.
And, it's just larger scale.
Well, with the removal of the Cherokee, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Cherokee on a legal action they had taken. Andrew Jackson said, well, yeah, that's great for the Supreme Court to make that decision, but now let them enforce it. I'm going to do what I want to do. And he did.
There's a point where Cooper is trying to get in to see, I think it's one of the secretaries, one of the people in the cabinet, and he can't do it. He doesn't have the money to do it, to even get in there. And that hasn't changed.
Yeah, I think it's human nature and political nature.
When you're doing that kind of research and you begin seeing those kinds of parallels, I mean, do little light bulbs go flashing at that point in your brain?
I try not to draw connections between then and now. But my feeling about historical fiction is that it's always going to be as much about the time the writer is living in as the time that the story is set in. That the Scarlet Letter is probably as much about the United States in the 1860s as it is Puritan-era United States. I think it would be just about inevitable, whether you're trying or not trying, that some of those things that are in the air in the world you live in are going to enter into the world you're creating.
In retrospect, if you think back about the writing, can you see any specific points where it becomes more obvious to you? Maybe not in the initial writing when you're trying to put it aside, but later.
Well, I certainly think that there are a lot of things in this book about identity, about cultural identity, racial identity, about these big sweeping changes, that this period of time is when Native American culture on the East Coast was being swept away and was in danger of disappearing entirely, totally overwhelmed by our culture. I think issues like that were certainly on my mind.
Lippincott's, was that a story paper?
I can't remember whether there was a Lippincott's magazine, and I don't remember whether the thing I used there was an actual article from Lippincott's or whether I made up an article from Lippincott's.
Were the journalists that you used, the two or three of them, were they real people?
Based on real people. I mean, William Holland Thomas was dealt with by journalists over many, many decades. He was interviewed, he was written about. The last time during his life, this writer said, when you ask about William Holland Thomas, you get everything from this saintly benefactor of the Indians to a madman chained to the floor of his house.
I think the greatest feat that Will Cooper accomplishes is saving Wyah and his own tribe of Cherokees by buying up as much land as he can, even if he doesn't really own it.
Yeah.
Is that based on William Holland Thomas or someone else?
Yeah, it's based on a plan that he and Yanaguska came up with for saving their territory. And they bought and had all this tangle of deeds and IOUs and loans and all this. They had hundreds of thousands of acres tied up at one point, and then it all began falling apart. So what's left is a fraction of that became the core of the land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee.
But it's still there today.
Yeah.
So this guy is a hero to those people. He's got to be.
One of the things I tried to do in the book is make it clear that this guy owes them a debt, not the other way around. When he was an orphan with nowhere else to go in the world, they took him in, gave him a community to be part of, and that he always felt you had something to pay back. And also that William Holland Thomas wrote of Yanagiska that he had known presidents, senators. He had never met anybody who could outshine Yanagiska intellectually. And so I assumed from that that Yanagiska was kind of the brains of the operation. There's a scene where after the removal, there was this land auction, and a huge amount of land that had been part of the Cherokee Nation was auctioned off. And Yanagiska Bear in the book just sits down and smooths out a piece of bare ground and draws a map of his vision of what he wants them to have, and just tells Will, okay, now go do it, make it happen, but here's the vision.
Charles Frazier, you wrote Coal Mountain. We're going to go back a little bit here for a second. You wrote Coal Mountain, submitted it. It was published by an established press, Atlantic Monthly, not a major press. And then the reviews came in, and the book took off. Where were you at the time, and what was your reaction to all this?
Oh, I was probably out on the road on book tour as all that was happening. I mean, it's not the kind of thing any writer of a first novel would, I don't think, unless you were delusional, would let yourself imagine. I was just hoping I'd sell enough books to get a better teaching job.
And it continued, and you won the National Book Award, and suddenly your life changed. You had money. I mean, it just poured in.
This didn't happen to me when I was 24. I was in my 40s. And, you know, was kind of, had a life, had an established life, had a really nice house, a small farm in central North Carolina. There's certainly a cushion there that wasn't there before. But in a lot of ways, the everyday part of life of a writer is that going out by yourself to a room. And that part hasn't changed.
Do you find it easier, for instance, in writing 13 Moons, did you find it easier to do research because people knew who you were?
Occasionally, but mostly I prefer not to be recognized when I'm in a library. I did have a guy one day, I was in a rare books room, and asked for one item and worked on it for a while. And then in a minute, the guy came back with this entire cart of stuff related to what I had asked for. Was enormously helpful.
And the movie Coal Mountain, did you have anything to do with it at all?
I didn't have a job on the movie. Anthony Minghella is a really inclusive filmmaker, and he wants to hear opinions. So drafts of screenplays came my way, and I would comment on them. I went to Romania to watch a bit of the filming for a few days, but that's about it.
What did you think of the final product?
I liked a lot of things about it. I wish it had been filmed in North Carolina.
Is the terrain that different in North Carolina?
Well, for a lot of people, it probably looked okay. It looks a little too Western for me. But I liked what a lot of the actors in the movie did. Very happy that Renee Zellweger won her Oscar.
And now this book has been bought by Scott Rudin.
Yeah.
What's the status of that movie now?
About all I know is that they're just at the very early stages of thinking about screenwriters and those first steps.
And you're okay with just taking the money and letting it go?
I don't know what I would do on a movie. I mean, I can't read screenplays and understand them. It's like looking at an architectural drawing and trying to imagine the three-dimensional building. I don't do that well. I don't think writing a screenplay would necessarily be a good idea for me. And I think you have to accept that the book is your vision of the material, the movie is somebody else's.
Well, Charles Frazier, now you've got 13 Moons. Have you begun thinking about your next book?
Thinking, but nothing farther than that.
Do you plan on maintaining this historical fiction of a particular place?
I think I'm going to be out of the 19th century for a while. I can't imagine going back to that period. I've got a couple of ideas that would both be 20th century books.
We're not going to see another Charles Frazier novel for a few years at this point.
The two ideas I'm thinking on, would both be short novels, so I'm hoping it won't be 9 years.
You ever get an idea of writing short stories or tackling a screenplay or even a play?
Short stories, I have a hard time with something that brief. I could possibly imagine collaborating on a screenplay. I don't think I would come up with anything usable on my own on that.
One final question. You've taught writing, and now you've written two novels. Can writing be taught?
Well, I never taught creative writing. Okay. I had those kind of the grunt work of a university teaching freshmen expository writing, and I never took creative writing. So I have no direct experience with that. I think what creative writing programs, MFA programs, can do is replicate the conditions of a published writer, in that you have an audience in the classroom, you have an editor in the form of the teacher of the class, and you have a deadline.
And what about what you actually did? How do you think those years teaching freshman English, teaching all of those books, how did that play a role in the final metamorphosis of Charles Frazier into novelist?
I think mainly it was impetus to do something besides that led me to writing a novel.
You've been listening to an interview with Charles Frazier, whose latest novel is 13 Moons. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.